The History Show with Mars Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme...
By the end of the day, 15 German tanks had been destroyed by my six guns. Try that on for size.
D-Day and the battle for Normandy, 70 years on. The ghost that haunts Huntingdon Castle... And up went Nelson. We look back at the destruction of the pillar in 1966. And that's where we begin. For over 150 years, Nelson's pillar dominated O'Connell Street in Dublin. The granite structure was erected in the early 19th century to commemorate the British naval commander Horatio Nelson. He was killed, of course, in 1805 at the Battle of Trafalgar, Britain's most decisive naval victory of the Napoleonic Wars. The monument received a mixed reception from the very start and was a subject of debate from the day it was unveiled in 1809 until its destruction by a bomb on the 8th of March 1966. Michael Lawless took to the streets this week to hear how people remember the destruction of Nelson's pillar.
I remember it being blown up. I can vaguely remember being woken up one morning on the radio and the pictures in the paper that evening of half the column still remaining.
I was around when it was blown up, yeah. They should have left it there.
I was in town the night it was blown up. I was at a dance up in the Galway Arms. We were all only teenagers. And we always walked
home. Yeah, I'm very sad that it's gone. What they put up instead of it is a total disgrace.
I remember it was boom. You hear the same with the bombings in. I was coming out of work too, 17th of December at 5. I remember that one as well. And everyone was running into O'Connell Street for a bit of the rock and a bit of the dust and everything.
I do remember it being blown up. It was there one day and it was gone the next.
Michael Lawless talking to people there about how they remember the destruction of Nelson's pillar. And I'm joined by Donal Fallon, author of a new book, The Pillar, The Life and Afterlife of Nelson's Pillar. Also here with me is photographer Paul O'Dear, whose photographs of the bombing's aftermath appear in the book. You're both very, very welcome indeed. Now, I said that it dominated O'Connell Street for 150 years. It didn't, because it dominated Sackville Street for many of those years, from 1809 until the 1920s. What kind of a street was Sackville Street and then O'Connell Street?
Indeed, well, long before McDonald's, Eddie Rockets and Burger King took over, it was very much a residential street when laid out in the 18th century. And the end product of Luke Gardner, the banker and developer, his great vision for the city. Henrietta Street is another Gardner Street, but Sackville Street was envisioned as a residential street which would attract the wealthy elite of Dublin. So Nelson's Pillar, or the Nelson Pillar, the proper title, but Dubliners always knew it as Nelson's Pillar or the Pillar. When the Nelson Pillar goes up, it's a very different environment that it's placed in. It's not surrounded by commercial units as it is today. It's very much in the middle of a residential street.
A very broad residential street. Was that unusual for Dublin at the time?
Indeed. And I think you get, even today, you get a sense of the importance of that street when you look at the sheer width of it and the White Streets Commission and their vision. I think O'Connell Street, even now, it feels like an important street, even if that's not necessarily reflected in the units that are there now.
When did the idea of constructing a monument to Nelson in Dublin first emerge, and where did the initiative come from? Did it come from Dublin? Did it come from London?
Dublin is remarkably early in commemorating Nelson. In fact, the pillar goes up over 30 years before Nelson's column. In London. It's by no means the first monument that's erected to Nelson, but still, even in a global context, it's very, very early. It's only a few short years after Nelson's death at Trafalgar in 1807 that there's talk about commemorating Nelson in the city, and it's the aldermen of Dublin and also leading business figures from across the religious divide, both Catholic and Protestant, that are pushing for a monument to Nelson. Some interesting Dublin families pop up here. The Latouche family, the Huguenots, who've been very involved in banking, they're involved. A little known family called the Guinnesses. Arthur Guinness is involved. It's not Arthur's Day Guinness, but the son, Arthur Jr. He's there and he's on the committee that puts up the pillar. So it's a very broad cross-section of Irish life and across the religious divide.
Nowadays, when you want to build anything, there's a competition. Was there a competition for the design of this memorial?
There is. And the winner, unfortunately for him, it's not quite his design that goes up. William Wilkins wins the competition, but the Nelson Pillar that goes up is the work of Francis Johnson, one of the great architects of Dublin's history. He gave us a general post office. The chapel in Dublin Castle is another example of his work. Ultimately, despite the fact Wilkins won the competition, the committee had to say that they couldn't afford to bring his vision to fruition. So it's Francis Johnson who gives us the pillar.
And tell us about the reaction then to the pillar when it was completed in 1809.
There's a wide variety of reactions, primarily negative, it should be said, though often not for political reasons. From what I can see, the most vocal political opposition comes from a magazine, The Irish Monthly. Watty Cox, who'd been around the United Irish movement.
A real contrarian, if ever there
totally,
was
totally. If there was ever one, he had nothing good to say, and from a political point of view. But he's really the only one that makes the obvious connection that Ireland had an attempted revolution in the 1790s, backed by the French, and here was a man who had played a role in defeating the French, suddenly in the centre of Dublin. More people raise opposition to how it looks. There's quite a lot of opposition on aesthetic grounds. And that was a theme right through the life of the pillar. Right into the 50s, people were calling it a traffic obstacle or whatever else. But in the early 19th century, people thought it was disproportionate and that it took away from everything around it.
Now, a tale that has become something of a legend of Easter week in 1916 is that the rebels attempted to blow up the monument, the Nelson's Pillar. Is that actually true? Did that happen?
The fault for this one rests with the famous Sinn Féin Rebellion Handbook, a great-selling publication. The Irish Times are behind it. It came out not long after the rebellion, and it tells a story of an attempt by volunteers to blow up the Nelson Pillar. Some of the international media, there was one New York newspaper that claimed Nelson's Pillar was gone in the aftermath of the Rising, that it was one of the structures that was lost to the flames of Easter week. The story that they attempted to blow it up, there's nothing to it. There's nothing to it at all. The volunteers were testing grenades. A grenade had gone off in the general post office, almost killing all around it. And there was a decision made to test grenades against Nelson's Pillar. But there was no belief that it was going to bring down the structure.
It would have been very easy, I suppose, for it to have disappeared in 1916, given
Indeed.
What happened
well,
to Sackville Street.
Think about the Helga. Yeah. She seems to smack everything except Daniel O'Connell and Admiral Nelson. it's remarkable they were still there. It was actually used by rebels in 1916. In some of the Bureau of Military History statements, rebels talk about the gauntlet of O'Connell Street, trying to get from one side to the other, from one occupied position to another, and how the pillar actually... rather than Republicans blowing it up, they availed of it because they could kind of hide in the doorway of Nelson's Pillar.
And they didn't have anybody up there as observers, using, you know, given the altitude of the
pillar. They didn't. Someone went up in 1917 on the first anniversary of the Rising and put a tricolour up there. But during the week in 1916, they didn't.
You'd think that was probably something of a mischance. Now, after Ireland then gained its independence, was there a renewed discussion about what are we going to do with your man in O'Connell Street?
Some argue he should stay. William Butler Yeats argues that it is not a beautiful object, in his own words, but that it means something to the Protestant people of Ireland. And Yeats makes an argument that it should remain. There's all kinds of bizarre movements to replace Nelson. There's a very strong movement in the 1930s to erect the statue of the Virgin Mary on top of the pillar. There's a movement led by a Fianna Fáil Cumann, I think in Donegal. They wanted a statue of Robert Emmet to go on top of the pillar. And their argument was maybe it will inspire Protestant men in the north. You see this courageous Protestant gazing down over Dublin, Robert Emmet. In 65, my favourite one, Red Mike Quill, a radical trade unionist in New York City who'd come from County Kerry, he lobbies the government. And what he wants is one of three. He wants one, Pádraig Pearse, if Pearse is too controversial, Jim Larkin. And if they're both too controversial, John F. Kennedy. This is 65. And the Transport Workers Union, they offered to finance the removal of Horatio and his replacement with a statue of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, well, Larkin actually does make it to O'Connell Street eventually.
Indeed. Yeah,
but not that exalted height. So by the 1960s, was the pillar considered to be a symbol, an outdated symbol of British imperialism? What was the attitude by then?
I think Thomas Bodkin, in a radio lecture, he said, to me, it wasn't Nelson's Pillar or the Nelson Pillar. It was just a pillar. I think to a lot of people in Irish life, it was a viewing platform. And that was how it was regarded. I think by the 60s, for the most part, any kind of political controversies around the monument, I think had kind of fallen away.
You're nodding, Paul. Would you agree with that? To you,
yeah,
when you were growing up, it was the pillar.
That was my feeling. It was just the pillar, yeah. It was something that Dubliners, for the greater part, never went up unless you were shown somebody around, which is how I ended up going up the thing. But since it came down, My attitude to it was it should have been left well enough alone, and the most that should have been done was that if a statue was going to be put up or any monument put up, it shouldn't have been higher than the statues between O'Connell and Parnell, like whatever was going up there, so it didn't take from the street as it was. But unfortunately, Celtic Tiger hubris interfered.
We'll talk to you in a moment about your memories of the 8th of March 1966. Obviously, you weren't there when the pillar was blown up, but you were there in the aftermath. Tell us what is known, Donal, about that operation, which may or may not have been an IRA operation.
There's a massive mythology around this. And this was the 50th anniversary year of the Easter Rising. Certainly, this action, I think, overshadowed anything the state could do in 66. And when you ask people about the 50th anniversary of the 1916 Rising, their abiding memory is not the Garden of Remembrance or the march down O'Connell Street. What they remember is the pillar being blown up. What they can't quite remember is who did it. And the mythology, the folklore has it that this was the IRA. I suppose in modern language, we would blame this on dissidents. This was the work of a group of former IRA members, a kind of a left-wing cell, if you will, that had been inside and by this point was outside of the IRA, kind of largely around Joseph Crystal, a brilliant cyclist. When he died, the obituaries talked plenty about his time as a cyclist and little about his time as a Republican. Crystal was one of the people that was up Nelson's Pillar in 1955. Students attempted to burn down Nelson with flamethrowers. Crystal was up there on that occasion. But the group around Crystal, what's become known as the Crystal Group, were very much involved in the ultimate downfall of Nelson. Liam Sutcliffe is the only Republican that has publicly placed himself there. At the turn of the millennium, in an interview on RT Radio, he talked about the story of blowing up the pillar and how, in fact, they had gone up prior to the 8th of March and left an explosive device that failed to go off, and having to retrieve that bomb and plant another one, which went off at 1:30 in the morning of the 8th of March. Sutcliffe had been in the IRA, though by this point was outside of it. So it's not an IRA-sanctioned action. The IRA often condemned the bombing of monuments in the 40s, the 50s and the 60s. They see it as a kind of sideshow. Now, Unverblockt does find the humour in what's happened to Nelson. They're certainly not condemning the bombing of the Nelson Pillar, but they're making it clear it wasn't them too.
Now, the rest of the day then, Paul, what are your memories of that? You were presumably there taking photographs. Yeah, there must have been a lot of curiosity.
I wasn't there that night, but I certainly turned up because I was in the habit of having a camera on me anywhere I went since my early teens. And I turned up. I was in UCD at the time, so I could afford to divert slightly on my way into college. And I turned up there virtually every day between the day that it was blown up and the day that there was just a piece of flat nothingness there. People were curious. I mean, it's the normal rubberneck stuff that was going on, like, and it was a huge event. I don't think people were too worried one way or the other. It was just a great big circus as far as people were concerned, and like, it wasn't seen necessarily as a political act, except maybe by a few people.
Mm. Because, but it was because architectural demolition.
Yeah, because the landmark, it wasn't gone, but it was staring at you, and it had this little piece, which was the actual round part that Nelson stood on, perched up on the top of it at an angle, and it looked like it could have fallen at any minute. And at the time, I thought that was the top of the pillar, but looking at the photograph since, I realised that about a third of the actual column had gone. And this thing had come down and sat about a third of the way down the pillar on the top of the thing. And of course, the rest of it had bounced off the base and broken traffic lights and gone into windows and this taxi guy nearly.
But didn't cause quite as much damage as the controlled demolition, so-called, that took place a short time, or it was about a week or so afterwards. This was the army who basically what?
You're being provocative.
Did they or did they not break every window in O'Connell Street?
This is the great one, the joke, you know, leave it to the professionals.
Yeah.
You would expect the army would have done more damage because their explosives, their charge would have been closer to the ground.
Mm, absolutely.
so you would expect them to do significantly more damage. But looking at the compensation claims, it doesn't actually appear that they did. So I think everyone saw the joke before their eyes and couldn't resist.
So that's another myth as well.
Humour is really what shines true after the pillar's thrown.
Red rag to a bull. I found myself, this one is thrown anytime the pillar comes up. I was in the little museum there recently going around. There's a beautiful big picture of the pillar on the wall. And some woman in the crowd that was going around said, yeah, the army did an awful mess of this. Yes, I took the head off her.
Humour really shines through. There's the joke about the army doing more damage. There's a Dubliner single, which is hilarious. Nelson's Farewell. And it was that great one, I can see Cleary's now, the pillar's gone. You know, humour was right there after the
Well, I don't know if you want to talk about it, but the army, apart from doing a very efficient job, the army actually provided the people of Dublin with a night's entertainment that they would never forget. It was floodlit, and the crowds were, there was jollity all around the place. There were a few Welsh people left over from a Welsh match that were trying to figure out what was going on.
They laid a wreath at the side as well.
Did they? They were looking totally lost. But there was a commentary on the tannoy from the GPO. Kevin O'Kelly was given a commentary, which was every bit as exciting as his subsequent moon landing. And it was 3-2-1, the thing went off and the place went absolutely berserk.
And you were there taking photographs?
Oh, I was there taking photographs, and I was on a Honda Cub with Tom Ferris, a friend of mine, and we went around up the Parnell Street end and everywhere. And God bless the army. This was better than the Artane Boys band, I'll have to say that.
And God bless Nelson's head, because that was the gift, Donald, that kept on giving, wasn't it?
Oh, God, it really was. One of my favourite images in the book is students from the National College of Art and Design who liberated Nelson's head from a corporation shed. They photographed themselves with Nelson's head, and they're wearing balaclavas and scarves around their faces. The student union was very heavily in debt in NCAD, and they saw an opportunity to make a few quid here. They went on to live very exciting lives. One became an actor in the Reardons, one became a lecturer in NCAD, but they would gift out Nelson's head to anyone who was willing to pay for it. It ended up, Paul, as a photograph of it at Killiney Beach. It ended up on stage with the Dubliners. It ended up in an antique shop in London. Benny Gray rented it off these students quite a while. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, Benny Gray returned it on the back of a lorry. He drove down O'Connell Street in the back of a lorry with the Dubliners. And they played a kind of edited version of Nelson's Farewell, Nelson's Return. And when he got to the General Post Office, he asked if anyone was from the corporation, and it was handed over. So it was another bemusing spectacle in the whole story.
Paul, tell us about that photograph. It's in the book, and this is the photograph of young men standing around an old mini on the beach at Killiney with Nelson's head.
Yeah, I was out for a walk, and I happened to have my camera with me, which I normally had just had. And I was up at the Holy Child Bridge, and I saw across at Holman's, which is the far end of the beach, there was something funny going on at the shoreline. There was a boat drawn up and there were some sort of odd-looking people at it. So I went charging off. By the time I got there, everybody was in normal gear and whatever. And there was a little Austin Mini down on the beach, and there was a sack halfway up the beach that had left a huge big ridge. It took four fellas to pull it up the beach, and that was fine. So I started taking shots of the guys at the Mini, and one fella ran around and sat in front of the registration number. So I thought, this is something serious going on, and then I forgot about it. I just had the negatives, and that was it. And very shortly afterwards, a fashion photo appeared in the evening press of the boat, the prow of the boat, these guys with their oars on either side as a sort of guard of honour, Nelson's head down at the bottom of the boat, and two ones in fashion clothes in the boat.
Who'd kind been, of mod fashion.
Yeah, fashion stuff, who'd been from Boylan's, who'd been patched in the studio. So the guys had obviously flogged the picture to Boylan's for this. So Nelson has actually been in a serious fashion shoot in Killiney Beach.
He still gets around. Where is he today, though? Where's the head today?
Dublin City Library and Archives on Pierce Street. And he's sitting there in the reading room. You can go and see him with a chip in his lip from 1916.
But no chip on his shoulder. Thank you very much indeed for that. Highly entertaining. And Donald's book, The Pillar, The Life and Afterlife of Nelson's Pillar, featuring many photos by Paul O'Dear, is published by New Ireland Books. Donal and Paul, thank you both very much for joining us this evening. And you can see a lot of those photographs on our website. After the break, a personal recollection of the Normandy landings to mark the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Welcome back. This coming Friday, the 6th of June, marks the 70th anniversary of D-Day. On that day, in 1944, the Allies landed in Normandy and began to liberate mainland Europe from Nazi occupation. 92-year-old Brian Stewart is one of a dwindling band of Normandy survivors who can still describe this complex and bloody campaign. The Black Watch captain talked to Liam Geraghty about his experience of World War II.
My name is Brian Stewart. I was a captain in the Black Watch during the war. I was not a regular soldier, wartime only.
We did it before and we can do it again, and we will do it again. We got a heck of a job to do, but you can better...
Brian Stewart had been studying in Oxford when he joined the war effort, and he felt better prepared than most.
But I'd already done my basic training. I had been learning to march and drill as a cub and a Boy Scout. And all the way through my school time, we were learning these kind of things, which was, of course, not true of everybody. I wasn't proposing to be a soldier, but I was always interested in the military affairs and very proud of the Scottish military history. But, of course, it's not only Scottish history. I'm half Irish anyway. And, of course, half our generals, the best ones, were Irishmen.
Brian's first realisation of the scale of the war came as the troops, including his battalion, the Black Watch, got ready to leave for Normandy.
Of course, the first thing was the assembly of this huge army, this incredible force on the south coast of England. And it's impossible to imagine what it looks like when the whole of the ground is covered with tanks and lorries, soldiers and tents. The whole of the sky is full of aeroplanes, one to another, and barrage balloons, and you can't see anything anywhere except military ships. And it was an amazing sight.
On June 6, 1944, D-Day, the Allied invasion of Normandy took place. It was the largest seaborne invasion in history. 156,000 Allied troops fought against the Germans there. Brian's battalion arrived soon after the initial invasion.
So off we went across the channel, in my case, in what is called a landing ship tank. And we arrived the other side, no problems. And the beach had already been cleared. Flail tanks knocked out the mines, and there we were, on shore. But there were no Germans. They'd been pushed back a little bit.
For the rest of the month, Brian and his men were involved in minor skirmishes and anti-tank warfare. As Brian says, they were there as support.
And so we knocked out the odd tank and we knocked down the odd wall, but we didn't actually do very much because we were the second line as far as the attack was concerned. So I was an observer of the battalion's attacks. You know, it's a rather curious position to be in. You see, it was ready to go forward, but we were not at the front.
But that was about to change.
And the night of the 30th of June, we were briefed by the colonel that we would go up to the front and take over a position, and we'd expect an attack by the Germans the next morning at dawn.
When early morning came, they heard the rumble of German Panther tanks approaching.
And then through the dawn mist, we see these large monsters looming up, you see. And they're peering about and their guns are swinging. But they can't see us. And I trained my chaps, you do not fire at German tanks as they advance towards you. They have 4-inch armour and your shells will bounce off them. You wait until the tanks have gone past. Of course, this needs discipline. I mean, obviously the instinct is the enemy's coming up, we'll fire. But my gunners did not fire. They just stayed quiet. But when the German tanks got past them, we hit them. By the end of the day, 15 German tanks had been destroyed by my six guns. Try that on for size. But unlike most people, I enjoyed the war. Not the war, but I enjoyed being a soldier. You know, I didn't join the war at all in the sense that my brother was killed, all my best friends were killed. So I didn't enjoy the war in that sense. But personally, I was lucky. I survived. I didn't finish up in a Japanese prisoner of war camp or labor camp or whatever. We had done our job. Job satisfaction is called out.
We did it before, we'll do it again.
Captain Brian Stewart of the Black Watch talking to Liam Geraghty there. Brian's the author of Smashing Terrorism in Malaya, The Vital Role of the Police. And another recently published book, which may be of interest, is Irish Officers in the British Forces, 1922-45 by Stephen O'Connor, which is published by Palgrave Macmillan. This year's History Festival of Ireland takes place next weekend, the 7th and 8th of June, in the sumptuous surroundings of Huntingdon Castle in County Carlow. Apart from hosting this year's festival, the castle has an infamous relationship with Gothicism and the occult. I'm joined by festival curator Angus Mitchell and a past inhabitant of Huntingdon. We'll come to that shortly. Angus, you're very welcome.
Good evening, Miles.
Now, the original tower house dates back to the 15th century, and the castle was the setting for Stanley Kubrick's film Barry Lyndon, one of the locations that was used. It's got a fascinating history. A famous inhabitant of Huntingdon was a woman called Olivia Robertson, a member of an old Irish ascendancy family. Tell me a little bit about her. She's eccentric, to put it mildly.
Yeah, Olivia was born in 1917. And she had this very privileged access to the intelligentsia of Ireland in the early 20th century. And very early on in her life, in her 20s, having studied art, she took up the pen and began to write novels. And in the late 40s and early 50s, she became a very respected novelist in her own right. She wrote a book which is perhaps her best known work, St. Malachy's Court, and another book which is a kind of fantasy about Clonagall, the village which she grew up in, which is called The Field of the Stranger. And then really, Olivia, after finding success early in life, she to some extent is reborn in the 1960s, really through her friendship with her brother, and with him they set up a what we would call a cult, I suppose, but in fact was an effort to establish the feminine side of the divine. And the Fellowship of Isis became quite a sort of gathering point for alternative culture in Ireland in the 60s and 70s. And Olivia, who carried on living well into her 90s, became the high priestess of this organisation.
Her brother had a vision that God was a woman, and she took it from there, did she?
That's right. Her brother was a clergyman in Norfolk for a while, and then I think he became slightly disillusioned with the Church of England and dreamt one night that God appeared to him and told him that God was in fact a woman. And this obviously caused a great crisis in his own sense of faith. He went to the Bishop of Ely and he told the bishop what had happened. And the bishop apparently, so the story goes, said, "Oh, don't worry, old chap. The fact that God is a woman is a small technicality. We can get over that." But Derry didn't get over that. And he returned to Ireland with his sister and they set up this cult, I suppose, is one way of calling it. But the centre for a sort of alternative faith.
And how many followers are we talking about? Are we talking about dozens, hundreds, or thousands?
By the end of her life, and she only died last year, there were tens of thousands of followers. around the world. And Olivia, in that circle, was hugely admired and respected. But over the years, over the 40 years when Huntington became the location or the centre for this organisation, it was amazing who passed through there just to kind of revel in the idea. You know, everyone from Mick Jagger to Charlie Hockey, I think. And, you know, the visitor's book is quite astounding, really, in terms of who went there.
You've spent a bit of time there yourself, so therefore you may have some personal experience of that other thing that I alluded to in the introduction, because Huntington has ghostly associations. Tell us about those.
Yes, there are a number of ghosts who have been seen in the house. There's supposed to be a Bishop of Limerick, actually, who appears in one of the bedrooms from now and again. And then I suppose the figure who is most fondly remembered is W.B. Yeats, who is supposed to have tried to spend a night in the library at Huntington, but he apparently, after a few hours sitting on his own in that room, came out saying that it was far too haunted and he couldn't possibly spend any more time in there.
Well, there's somebody who had an interest in the occult.
Yeah, for sure. And Yeats was very close to the family, although Nora, in her memoirs, isn't particularly polite about him.
And will Huntington and the Temple of Isis and perhaps the ghostly associations, will that be part of the discussions at the History Festival this year?
Yes, we'll have one session that will remember Olivia Robertson, but we've got some very significant speakers talking about different aspects of the esoteric, most notably Angela Burke, who's going to be talking about Jeremiah Curtin's tales of the fairies and of the ghost world, and then Nicola Gordon-Bowe, who's going to be talking about A.E. and George Russell and Yeats, Meg Harper, who's a professor of literature at Limerick University. She's going to be talking about Yeats's vision poems. So that's going to be a significant part of the festival, but we'll also, over the 2 days, be really concentrating also on the First World War. And there's, on the Sunday afternoon, a section dedicated to the history of Irish gardens.
OK, you can find details of this year's History Festival of Ireland on our website. The curator is Angus Mitchell. Angus, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Miles.
When we were discussing the incarceration of Alois Fleischmann on last week's programme, I mentioned that we received a piece written by Brendan Jenkinson about his great-grandfather, who was also held at Oldcastle Cab. Let's have a listen now to some of Brendan's essay on the subject, The Enemy Alien.
It is a strange fact that a mere 25 miles from where I was born and where I attended school lay the setting of my great-grandfather's incarceration during World War I, and that until recently I knew very little of it. Furthermore, it is an odd thing that the setting of my great-grandfather's wartime imprisonment was the Oldcastle Famine Workhouse in County Meath, which ceased to exist in 1920 and which history had, until very recently, largely forgotten about. In 1914, the British War Office acquired the local famine workhouse in Oldcastle, County Meath, and swiftly began making improvements to the security of the camp. Barbed wire, 5 feet high and 14 feet wide, ran along the camp perimeter, while 9 sentry boxes were placed throughout the grounds. The structure of the workhouse made it an ideal holding camp, while a railway line linked the camp directly with the port in Drogheda. In late 1914, in the dead of winter, the first trains carrying prisoners of war rolled into Oldcastle. 4 months earlier, on August the 5th, 1914, the British Parliament passed legislation permitting police officers to arrest German and Austrian men of military age, since they feared these men might engage in sabotage, spying, and generally act as a threat to British war interests. German and Austrian men living in Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales were all immediately under suspicion as enemy aliens. The men were arrested and interned in various camps throughout Ireland and the UK. Among these men was Heinrich Jobes, my great-grandfather. Heinrich and many other civilians were brought to Oldcastle, County Meath, where the British War Office was preparing themselves for the prisoners' arrival. In total, 760 internees would pass through the workhouse between December 1914 and May 1918. These internees came from a wide variety of backgrounds and professions, and many were skilled tradesmen. My great-grandfather was a hotel manager who had emigrated from Germany to Ireland in 1906. He had moved to Ireland to take up a post at the Great Southern Hotel in Killarney, where he met Irish girl Mary Ann O'Brien. Heinrich Jobes married Mary Ann O'Brien in the Pro-Cathedral in Dublin in 1913. The couple had a daughter and were living in London at the time of Heinrich's arrest and imprisonment. Adjusting to the monotony of camp life and the restrictions entailed therein was enormously challenging. These men had all been in gainful employment before their imprisonment, and many were married with children. They suddenly found themselves imprisoned without cause and rendered ineffective and idle. However, despite the severe boredom, or perhaps because of it, culture slowly began to spring up in the camp. In addition, the prisoners began communicating with the local people of Oldcastle. Many of the inmates were highly skilled carpenters and craftsmen and traded their craft with the Oldcastle locals in return for luxury food. As the war was drawing to a close, the camp was returned to the Oldcastle Board of Guardians and a Sinn Féin anti-conscription meeting was held in the square of Oldcastle. Thousands attended and the tricolour was raised. German internees were seen 300 metres away on the roof of the workhouse observing the events. When the war ended in 1918, my great-grandfather and his fellow internees were released. Heinrich returned to his wife and family and soon thereafter moved to Skerries, County Dublin, where they bought the Grand Hotel and where Heinrich lived out the rest of his life. Reassimilating to civilian life, he faced great personal pressures and social anxieties and sadly never fully recovered from his status as enemy alien.
And you can read Brendan Jenkinson's piece on our website. It was read there by Angus McAnally. Your emails about your relatives who were involved in World War One are continuing to come in. We've had emails too from people who've only recently discovered, or relatively recently, that their ancestors fought in World War One because these things were not discussed in the family. Keep your emails coming. People enlisted from every county in Ireland, and we'd like to represent as many as possible in our forthcoming World War One programmes. Email history@rte.ie. Just after the break, we'll be hearing about a notorious prison camp that operated during the American Civil War. Welcome back. Prison camps are an unavoidable factor in war, and that fact was no different during the American Civil War. The most infamous of them all was Andersonville, a Confederate prison that was overcrowded, disease-ridden and violent. This is where Waterford man Edward Wellington Boat found himself towards the end of the war, as Orla Rappel now reports.
The name Edward Wellington Boat is not one that conjures up endless articles when searched for on the internet. However, this Waterford man experienced life in a notorious Confederate prison during the American Civil War and made a stance against President Lincoln because of it, a stance that would affect his life in his adopted home.
He was a lone voice, really, and a lone detractor of President Lincoln. And again, even in this, his fellow journalists had the last laugh and they went to great lengths of saying unfavourable things about him, even in his obituary.
Edward Wellington Boat was born in Waterford in 1822.
He's an unusual surname. I suppose that's what really stood out. And the fact then that he was from Waterford, I suppose it really just kind of got me interested. I'd never come across the surname before. And the more I uncovered of his story and his life, the more interesting it became.
James Doherty is a local historian from Wellington Boat's home county.
Good background. He originally became a journalist. He worked as a journalist in Waterford, then briefly in London, and kind of made his way through his career in journalism to the States.
In America, Edward enlisted in the Union Army and joined the 42nd New York Volunteers.
Quite late in the war, so the war had been was well underway, so I suppose he knew what he was getting himself in for. He was actually captured quite quickly. He was captured quite at the Battle of Bristol Station, which was, although it was a Union victory, Edward was captured there. And it's really prior, or after, I should say, his capture, his life starts getting very interesting.
Edward was sent to Andersonville Prison, a Confederate prisoner of war camp in Georgia. It had opened in February 1864. It was originally 16 and a half acres and designed to hold 10,000 prisoners, but swiftly became overcrowded. By August 1864, the amount of prisoners there had tripled.
Really, I suppose you could call it a death camp. 25% of all the prisoners there died. It was over 40,000 Union soldiers held in Andersonville, and around 13,000 of them died of the conditions there. Ironically, one of the things that made the conditions so bad, or helped make the conditions bad, was the presence of a group within the prison called the Andersonville Raiders.
The Andersonville Raiders were a group of rogue prisoners. They terrorised their fellow inmates, preyed on new prisoners and stole food and possessions throughout the camp. As a result, their living conditions were considerably better than their fellow inmates.
Now, Boat was one of a group of inmates who said, kind of, enough is enough. They violently overthrew the power of the raiders within the prison camp, and they had a trial. Now, Boat, because of his experience as a journalist, worked as a clerk, and he recorded the details of this trial. The end for the raiders wasn't very pleasant, and the six leaders of this group were hung. And through this action of kind of restoring order within the prison, they came in contact with the commandant, a guy called Henry Wirtz.
Wirtz was a Swiss-born Confederate officer in the American Civil War. He was the commander of Andersonville for a year in 1864. During this year, the population of the prison camp peaked, so much so that it was the fifth largest city in the Confederacy.
And a lot of people argued that the prison guards really had as bad or as the similar conditions as the prisoners themselves, and they didn't have much better food.
Wirtz requested that a group, including Wellington Boat, would travel to the north to meet with Lincoln about the conditions in the prison.
There was a blockade situation in the south, and this blockade led to poor conditions, led to poor food and poor medicine going into the prisons. Edward Boat's mission was to meet Lincoln and plead for a relaxation of this blockade and try and encourage a prisoner exchange.
However, Edward and his group were not successful in their mission.
They never really got a good reception in New York. They didn't get to meet President Lincoln, and there wasn't really a relaxation of the conditions in the southern prisons. Some would argue that Lincoln was quite happy to leave a lot of Union soldiers in the prisons because he could afford to lose them where the South couldn't, so he didn't want the prisoner exchange. You know, it's open to debate.
The end of the American Civil War was declared just under a year after Wirtz sent Edward Wellington Boat on his failed mission to meet Lincoln. And in May 1865, the federal government put Wirtz on trial for conspiring to impair the lives of Union prisoners of war.
We next see Boat in history at the trial of Henry Wirtz. Uniquely, I suppose, Boat was one of the only people who stood up and pleaded in defence of Henry Wirtz at his trial.
At the trial, Boat pointed out that the poor conditions at the prison were somewhat due to the actions of President Lincoln.
Points he tried to get across were just dismissed out of hand. Unfortunately, I think Henry Wirtz's fate was predetermined when he went into that trial, and he was destined to be hung. He's one of the only people who were hung for war crimes in the American Civil War.
Boat's life in America did not fare well after testifying in defence of Wirtz.
Lincoln at this stage had been assassinated and had received almost godlike status in the North. And for Boat, it was, I suppose, either very brave or very foolish for him to come out and speak against President Lincoln. But ultimately, he paid the price. His career suffered as a journalist. His personal life suffered.
Edward Wellington Boat died in the early 1770s. His health never improved after experiencing Andersonville. Upon his death, his wife wrote an obituary to their local paper, an obituary that was preceded by the thoughts of the editor.
Edward Wellington Boat died last night in the county hospital in Flatbush. He was a man of good abilities and much miscellaneous newspaper experience, but of late years sacrificed self-respect to self-indulgence, and from being a writer of items, sank to furnishing police items for his former confreres to record. His wife, who has been alternatively the assistant of his literary labors and the victim of his neglect and ill usage, is left unprovided for.
For someone to survive Andersonville, if he hadn't taken the stance he had, he probably would have been viewed as a war hero in the North. But unfortunately, because he spoke out against Lincoln, he had the opposite effect. His career and his personal life were hampered at every turn. And again, even in death, his fellow journalists had the last laugh.
And the story of Waterford man Edward Wellington Boat was part of Orla Apple's series Irish Fighters, American War, which was produced with funding from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. Andersonville prison camp was known as the Auschwitz of the American Civil War. World War I has been dubbed the most significant event in modern Irish history. On Saturday, 14th of June, at Belfast City Hall, a conference will reflect on a decade of war and revolution here, as well as the road to World War I. I'm joined by one of the organisers, UCD historian Conor Mulvey. Conor, you're very, very welcome indeed.
Thanks,
just in relation to World War I, one of the aims of the conference is to take alternate Irish perspectives on questions like the economic impact of the war here. Was the war good or bad for the Irish economy?
This is one of the very complex questions to do with the First World War, Miles. I think what we need to do here is to split the urban and the rural in Ireland. From the rural perspective, this was obviously quite a bounty time for farmers. Any of the large wars that Britain was involved in, Ireland became the breadbasket and more importantly the beef basket of the British Army, and therefore had a huge massive economic impact in terms of bringing that food to the British Army and increasing agricultural prices. However, in urban areas, the question is quite different. On one hand, there was increased separation allowances for women, and in particular, we see women having a spending power within the urban economy during the First World War that they had previously not known on that scale and as a cohort of consumers in that way. However, spiralling food costs and rising food shortages were something that towards the end of the war began to seriously impact upon urban centres, particularly Dublin, Cork and Belfast. So the mixed perspective is something that we want to bring in on this.
Now, you mentioned separation allowances and you mentioned women in that context, but women's involvement in the war is also on the agenda at this conference. And did many Irish women actually go to France and Belgium on the medical side, obviously?
One of the things we're going to look at in the conference, particularly with people like Dr. Senny Passetto of Oxford University, is the role that women played on the home front, but also on the front line of the First World War on the Western Front and elsewhere, where they served in these medical roles. And I think that's one of the forgotten contributions of the First World War, particularly women who died at the Western Front, behind the front lines in those nursing and palliative roles within the conflict. So these are, again, part of bringing the forgotten voices of the First World War to the public and to a wider audience through this conference.
And what about the effect of the war on women on the home front, aside from the women who were in receipt of separation allowances?
As a historian of Ireland during this period, one of the largest questions for me is, why did women get the vote in 1918? And really here we're split between two questions. One is the question of the broad franchise and suffrage campaign that was waged from the first decade of the 20th century onwards and had a massive social impact throughout the period. However, in analysing why women got the vote in 1918, their transformed and metamorphosized role within society because of the war and because of their changing role on the domestic front in particular is a key aspect of their changed political status after 1918. So that's something, again, we want to visit.
And of course, while war was brewing, we had our own complications and tensions in this country. To what extent is the conference addressing those?
Again, I think this conference is about two things. It's about bringing Ireland into Europe and about bringing Europe into Ireland. And from our perspective, what we want to show is that there were really two flashpoints on each pole of Europe in 1914. And before Sarajevo took over the entire European psyche, Europe was looking to Ulster and looking to the powder keg that was about to explode in Belfast at that point, and whether there would be civil war in Belfast or in Dublin, and whether rival volunteer forces would either clash with each other or with military and police in that very tense summer in Ireland in 1914. So we want to address those simmering political developments that I suppose were about to boil over and were just cut short by the war. And then suddenly the change in volunteering, both from John Redmond's perspective, but also from Edward Carson's perspective, that volunteers who had been pledged towards acts that would have been seen as disloyal or certainly extrajudiciary by many, they suddenly became part of the war effort and became incredibly, I suppose, loyal to the British war effort throughout that period.
One of the things that astonished me was the fact that somebody like Asquith, for example, who was the British Prime Minister at the time, was to some extent relieved when the war in Europe began, because it meant that he wasn't going to have a civil war in his own doorstep. I mean, that seems astonishing in retrospect.
Absolutely. This is something that I think really has struck Irish historians. And Michael Laffin was one of the first people, former professor of history in UCD, who looked at this whole question. And he said, in reflecting on the First World War in 1915, Asquith wrote a reflective piece in which he discussed the First World War as a crisis which had actually saved his bacon and stopped him from being the Prime Minister who presided over a second English Civil War, and that the First World War was the greatest stroke of luck that could have ever happened to him in his political career. So a really different perspective on Irish history from that
way. Ran out of luck the following year, obviously, where he was replaced by David Lloyd George. Conor Mulva, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Reflecting on a decade of war and revolution in Ireland, 1914, the road to war will be held at Belfast City Hall on Saturday, 14th of June. You'll find details on our website, where of course you can also download this evening's programme. Our offerings next week include Mary Spring Rice's diary on board the 1914 Howth gunrunning vessel, the Asgard, and The Cruelty Man, Child Welfare, the NSPCC and the Irish State. Until then, for me, Miles Dungan, and producer Yeti Redmond, goodbye and enjoy the rest of your weekend.